Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 21st, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. This week, we bring you a series of stories related to the science special issue on prevention. We'll be talking about the economics of prevention, a preventive medicine task force in the U.S., a look at grocery stores and eating habits, and the growing challenge of Alzheimer's disease.
So the principal reason we're going to see so much of this is because people are surviving because other medical problems of late life are getting increasingly less.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. Say you launch a campaign to reduce heart disease in your community. You ship in more fruits and vegetables, you encourage kids to walk to school, and you subsidize preventive health measures like cholesterol testing. On the local scale, you may accomplish your goal. But what will happen to healthcare costs and the businesses that you no longer buy food from? Richard Smith spoke with me about the complicated economics of non-communicable disease prevention and why the big picture is so important.
Well, when we're talking about prevention of non-communicable diseases, we're really talking about changes in how we're going to live, you know, what we're eating and drinking and what transport we're taking and leisure time and all those sorts of things. And those are clearly going to have implications for the economy, for the industry we're talking about, and maybe even differences across countries. But the problem is we don't really know which industry or country is going to be affected by what sort of policy and whether that's going to be positive effect or negative effect and how much of an effect. And, you know, the importance of the economy to people and countries means that we have a massive gap trying to understand the desirability of these policies to reduce the risk factors. We have gaps in generating support for these policies from those who will gain positively from them economically. And we have a bit of a gap in understanding those people who might be negatively affected, because they're going to be the people opposing these policies, and we might need to think of other remedial policies for them so they're not quite so badly affected.
So at the very highest level, this is a step towards helping solve the problem of non-communicable diseases.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a huge problem, and so far it's really been very much the health community who've been trying to focus on this. And we learn big lessons from communicable diseases when, you know, it becomes very apparent that these diseases are very important for economies, that these wider impacts become very supportive for the health community in pursuing policies to address the diseases.
And so this review is what you call a macroeconomic perspective on the prevention of these non-communicable diseases, things like diabetes, cancer, heart disease. But can you explain the significance of macro versus microeconomics in this context?
Well, microeconomics is essentially concerned with you and me. It's concerned with individuals, and it's concerned with the things we sort of buy and consume and how we work and so forth in our daily lives. And so it's interested in a particular market or industry. So, for example, we might be concerned with you and I as consumers of alcohol and the effect in the alcohol market if we change its price or we try and restrict availability and so forth. Macroeconomics is concerned with what happens across lots of different industries and sets of consumers. So in this case, for example, the sort of the alcohol case, how might a change in pricing alcohol or restricting its availability affect things like restaurants or taxi firms or sporting events and all those sorts of things? And what macroeconomics is trying to do is take all those impacts together across the various sort of industries and consumer groups and say, when we take all these ripple effects into account, is the net impact at the top level of the economy, you know, positive or negative? So what does it mean for GDP or national income? What does it mean for employment, inflation, and so forth? The important thing really is that we've got this kind of feedback thing going on. So the NCDs are impacting on the economy, but also that the economy is impacting back into NCDs. And it's this kind of cyclical relationship that's really important to try to get to grips with, I think, and what the macroeconomics is trying to offer.
So let's move to a particular example that you outline in your paper, and that's on a so-called fat tax, or a, you know, a tax on fatty foods. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, this is, again, one of these policies that's related to lifestyle and is going to have a whole heap of effects beyond that which you're specifically looking at. It's been termed fat tax, but it's really about trying to adjust prices to sort of reduce consumption. And this sort of concept is really sort of taking hold and has been of interest across a number of countries looking at implementing these. Some have and some are thinking of it. And the argument's quite compelling at a sort of a simple micro basis. You know, if the current price of foods high in, you know, saturated fat, for example, it doesn't really reflect these negative health effects, then we're going to have overconsumption of this stuff. Mm. Governments can apply a tax so they can increase the price. And, you know, following simple economics, if you increase the price of something, the demand for it falls. And if we can reduce demand for these saturated fat products, then we should reduce risk factors for NCDs. Okay, so that makes sense on a very broad, simplistic kind of level.
Mm-hmm.
Really what we're trying to get to in the paper is say, yes, but from a macro perspective, what we know is that once the price of something changes, consumers adjust their consumption across the whole range of things that they have. So let's take this example and say, well, okay, let's say they reduce spending on beef. That's one alternative. The other is they might really, really like beef and actually reduce spending on something else to maintain that consumption of beef.
Less produce, for example.
Yeah, and that is two very different effects. So if they reduce their demand for beef, then that affects people who produce beef, the farmers. They're going to have reduced income. What if the consumers keep consuming their beef because they really like the beef and spend less on something else? They might spend less on fruit and vegetables. I mean, that's going to make their health worse. They might spend less on flat screen televisions or computer games or all sorts of things. And those industries are going to be affected in a sort of a positive or negative way. And those sort of ripples are going to go through. What we're trying to get at with the macroeconomics is trying to assess, you know, the context of all those ripples and bring it all together and say, overall, is this change in price going to be a good thing or a bad thing? And who's it going to be good and bad for?
So this whole system sounds just so complicated. There are so many variables going into the equation, coming out of the equation. You know, how do you propose to be able to make sense of all of this to actually bring a, you know, analysis that can be useful?
Mm-hmm. Really, the two points there. I mean, first is it's always important to be aware of the questions, even if you can't answer them. So being aware of the complexity is actually quite important as well. So we don't just pursue a policy thinking that we're just concerned about the evidence for that, but at least think about what are the likely further impacts going to be, some of which might be very easy to assess and some might be much harder, but at least we're starting with some of the right questions here. So that's one thing. The second is about the actual analysis itself, and clearly there's going to be some technical challenges, you know, trying to specify these causal pathways and mechanisms and things are going to be difficult. But they're surmountable to a greater or lesser degree, and there's certainly a lot of work has been done on developing macro models in other areas, for example, that are not health-related, but also that we've done a lot of work now, particularly at London School of Hygiene, on developing these models and applying them in a health context. An awful lot of work on things like pandemic influenza, for example, and now bringing in those methods to the NCD area. And I think it's also worth remembering that NCDs are going to affect the economy very profoundly and pervasively, and actually it's important to quantify these things to actually generate support for the agenda around NCD risk reduction and mobilize the resources for prevention. And I think there, again, get back to this idea that if we think about the parallels with communicable diseases, you know, the devastating impact of HIV, AIDS and malaria, you know, one of the pivotal points in progressing their agenda was when it was made very clear what the economic impact was going to be on particular countries, and bringing, you know, issues to finance ministers and to the World Bank, bringing those to the table made a big difference. And I think that's what we need to do here with NCDs as well.
So I think a lot of these models and analyses and reviews are very useful from an academic perspective. But it's another thing entirely to translate them to the policymakers who could then actually, you know, implement policies to reduce the people affected by non-communicable diseases. So can you just sort of outline some of the challenges in bridging that gap?
I think one of the important things that it will raise is who is going to win and lose and by how much. And actually, it's important to think of the losers in some of these scenarios. So I mentioned, for example, when we went through the beef example, you know, beef farmers might stand to lose income if we're persuading people to reduce consumption of red meat. Now, farmers in many countries, certainly in developed countries, are very powerful lobby groups. And if they stand to lose on something, they're going to join together and complain about it. One of the examples earlier was about, you know, price or availability of alcohol. And obviously the alcohol industry would have significant things to say. say about the thought of a price increase
right.
or restriction of availability of consumers to their products. And these are very important players. They're important because, yes, they do employ people and they are, you know, contributors to economies. But they're also important because they may be very powerful lobby groups against some of the policies that the health community are trying to implement. And not only that, we may see it on a more national, international level. So we did a paper a couple of years ago in The Lancet looking at what would happen if we started to eat more healthily in the UK, for example. But the impact of that on Brazil, because Brazil is a major exporter of red meats. And yes, we would stand to benefit somewhat in the UK from eating a little bit more healthily, but that could have quite devastating impacts on the economy of Brazil. So it's very important, and one of the things we try to stress in the paper is assessing these impacts, because it helps you assess who's going to be your supporters of these policies and who may potentially be positioned to oppose them, and what you can do about that, either to think of policies that would reduce the negative impacts, or at least be aware of who the players are in the game and what their position is going to be.
Right. What a complicated picture. Well, Richard Smith, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard Smith shares a macroeconomic perspective on non-communicable disease prevention in a review in this week's special issue. To read more from the special issue, visit www.sciencemag.org/special/prevention.
When you go to the doctor's office for a checkup, how do you know that every procedure is actually necessary? Nearly three decades ago, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services created a panel to answer this very question, the Preventive Services Task Force. I spoke with Science Deputy News Editor Elliot Marshall about recent controversies involving the task force and some proposed changes in how they make assessments.
There's an interesting contrast between the way this group of experts sees themselves and how they are perceived as working by the public. They deal with issues that affect public health, and everyone's encountered the issues that they deal with when they go to the doctor. So it's an interesting mix of politics and science.
So, Elliot, what does the U.S. need a preventive service task force for? What do they do?
We spend a great deal of money on checking our health and trying to prevent disease and looking for early signs of disease. And it turns out, when you investigate it carefully, as they do, a lot of it's unnecessary. Not only is it unnecessary, but it's also, it can be detrimental. So it's good to have somebody looking over these decisions that we make to see if we're on a sound course, whether we've got evidence for the things that we do when we visit the doctor.
So how does this task force go about deciding what preventative measures to review? What do they use as their indicators?
They take a very academic and very labor-intensive look at everything that's been published on a subject, and they try to find the best evidence for whether a procedure that you may be invited to undergo by your doctor really has solid evidence supporting a conclusion that it will do some good. That is, they look for evidence of efficacy.
So the task force isn't a regulator like the FDA. What kind of influence or power do they wield?
Their influence is that they're read by primary care doctors and nurses. So the message they put out goes to doctors all over the country, but also importantly, those who make decisions about what should be reimbursed, pay attention as well, and Medicare and Medicaid folks keep an eye on which procedures are worth doing and which are not. Looking at these folks, even though that's not explicitly their assignment, their judgment has tremendous influence throughout the medical community.
Does the task force take into consideration the costs that come into play when they're advising on what things are effective?
Well, when I asked Virginia Moyer, the chair of the task force, this question, she said no. I mean, they're explicitly told not to look at cost, and this is one of the points of controversy in their work. People think they do, but they do not. That's not their job. She said the main task of this group is to look at whether medical procedures work, whether screening procedures work, and they do consider the cost to a patient in an informal way, but not in the same way they consider other evidence. So it's something that sort of weighs in the balance, but they don't investigate cost as a primary issue.
This task force has been in the news recently because there's been some controversy lately surrounding some of their recommendations. Can you talk about some of these?
Well, I'll just mention the one that got them the most attention, which was in 2009. They took a look at the use of mammography to detect breast cancer early with an idea that you could intercept it and treat it and prevent death from breast cancer by having mammography. They had looked at this before. What was controversial was that they were looking at a specific age group, women in their 40s, and whether they should undergo regular annual mammograms. And a lot of people felt that these were a good idea because you catch a disease early. And they had looked at this in the past and sort of left it in a neutral area of said it's probably a good thing to do. Well, they came out with a decision that there wasn't evidence to support doing this. And this was hugely controversial because there are many advocacy groups that promote early screening for breast cancer who felt that 40-year-olds should undergo it. And there are also medical groups, doctors and oncologists who have advocated screening in this age group before. So it was a controversial decision, drew a lot of attention, including a lot of attention in Congress. When they looked at the evidence on the recommendation for having a regular mammogram, they discovered that there were so many false positives with serious consequences, including, in many cases, biopsy and further invasive procedures that could lead to medical problems. In addition, there's all the worry that goes with a message that you may have cancer. All of these things, when they looked at the number of false positives, really outweighed the benefit, which was a small number of cancer deaths that could be prevented by screening in this age group. They just said it's not worth doing. You cause more harm than you do good. You give more people concern about cancer who will never have cancer as a lethal condition than it's worth. You send people who don't need to go in for biopsies to go and have a biopsy. The numbers in this age group are so large that the scales weigh in the balance of waiting rather than getting a mammogram.
So what have been the reactions among the government and the public towards the recommendations of this task force?
In this case, there was a very loud and public rejection of the advice because many people who were involved in cancer prevention felt that it was better to take the risk of having false positive than to take their advice. So there were hearings in Congress, a lot of statements issued opposing their advice. In the end, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, even held a press conference and gave word to the nation that people should really sort of do what they'd always been doing, that is, use good judgment, talk to your doctor, and do what you think is best.
So in essence, the mammography study was simply telling women to use their best judgment before getting a possibly unnecessary treatment. Why was this so controversial?
Some people have described what happened with the mammography screening decision as a perfect storm. For example, Mike McGuinness, who's at the Institute of Medicine, called it that because he said it came at a time when national elections were occurring. There was a large and very vehement debate going on about the reform of the health insurance. And also, he felt that the message coming out of the task force was poorly communicated, that they used rather academic, obscure terms to describe their reasons for reaching their decision. And since then, they've been trying to get a better handle on how to communicate how they do their analyses.
So the task force recently made a decision about prostate exams. Can you tell me what was different about that?
Actually, they came to a more negative conclusion, which was that the evidence actually shows that you should not recommend that procedure for anyone. No healthy person should undergo that test. It should be reserved for people who are at risk of cancer for some other reason. So that was also controversial, but it didn't seem to kick up as much public noise and concern, possibly, members of the task force say, because the earlier one came just at the time of national elections and when there's a lot of debate about national health insurance reform. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the second case of reviewing prostate cancer screening also led to objections from those who treat people with prostate cancer and medical groups, advocacy groups, and more than that, a bill has been introduced in Congress that would overhaul the task force by mandate from Congress, changing the makeup of the task force.
So were these recommendations made by the government followed?
Well, one of the consequences of the big furor over the mammography decision was the task force sort of changed the way it communicates information. They tried to make it much more comprehensible, easy to understand, clearer. But they also changed their procedures for getting input from the outside, and they now invite the public to comment before they review a new issue, as they're reviewing an issue, and after they've issued their draft decision. So they didn't used to do that. They used to just consult with some educated peers, experienced peers, about what they should do. Now they've opened up their procedures a bit. So that's one major change. Meanwhile, this bill in Congress has proposed that they introduce medical specialists onto the panel in order to get direct advice from the people who will be impacted by a decision. They've also been told that they should include advocacy groups, like those who perhaps would advocate breast cancer screening or prostate cancer screening, on the review panel. When I spoke to the chair of the task force about this, she said that she thought that would defeat the purpose of the panel because you would lose objectivity. And in some cases, the decisions would affect the financial interests of those who are advocates. In case of radiologists or urologists who might be advocating it, both because they think it's good medicine and because it's what they do.
Well, Elliot Marshall, thanks for talking with me.
Well, thank you very much.
Science's Elliot Marshall discusses the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force in this week's special issue.
By the year 2050, it's estimated that 100 million people around the world will have dementia. In 2012, there's no way to delay or treat these types of disorders, but we can detect them well before serious symptoms arise. Sarah Crespi spoke with Dennis Silko, the author of A Perspective on Preventing Alzheimer's Disease, about ongoing trials aimed at reducing Alzheimer's biomarkers.
Alzheimer's disease is an overwhelming global problem in our societies. It's been very disappointing that there have been recent major trial failures, clinical trials that didn't show a real benefit for symptoms. However, they did show some benefit for what we call biomarkers of the disease, measured in spinal fluid or in brain imaging. This means we can now move to what we call secondary prevention trials, trials in people who have signs of Alzheimer's and in whom we hope to prevent the disease progression with certain agents that we already have in hand. And the hope is that we will reposition the field for success by moving much earlier in the clinical development of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, as you say, this is a global problem and it's growing. Why are we going to see more people with Alzheimer's in the next few decades?
One of the principal reasons is that so many people are expected to live into very late life, and we see that all around us. We know that people over 85 are the single fastest growing segment of the population in many developed nations. And even in less developed nations in the third world, we also see clear evidence of rising prevalence of Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. So the principal reason we're going to see so much of this is because people are surviving because other medical problems of late life are getting increasingly less.
So as we cure other things or prevent other things or delay other things, this becomes the primary problem for the people over 85?
Right, and even much earlier than 85. So I use the example of how quickly the population over 85 mm-hmm. is developing, and they will certainly have a lot of Alzheimer's. But after 60 or 65, there's also a rapid rise in those people who are having less heart attacks, sometimes less death from cancer or pulmonary disease, and they sadly are rewarded for their successful aging by having the possibility of developing Alzheimer's.
And this is a disease that's really difficult to treat or take care of the people who are who come down with it.
Yeah, we always say that there are at least two major victims of the disease, the patient and the patient's principal caregiver. This always affects more than just the individual, even more so than many, many other diseases, because it robs the patient of their most human qualities, their ability to reason and remember and use language and emotional control. And therefore, others have to take care of them essentially 24/7.
Right. Well, over the past few decades, as this problem has gotten bigger, we've also made a lot of strides in detecting, you know, new biomarkers for Alzheimer's disease. Can you take us through some of the advancements in that area?
There's been an intensive effort worldwide for about three decades to understand the origins of Alzheimer's, what causes the disease, and what drives it forward. And what we've learned from all that is that there's a very long preclinical or pre-symptomatic phase that may be as long as 20 or 30 years before patients first forget where they parked their car or what they said in a conversation yesterday. And so this long pre-symptomatic phase has been studied quite intensively. For example, in people where we know they're going to get Alzheimer's because they have certain genetic mutations that lead to an aggressive form of Alzheimer's. And what that translates into, that kind of study, is that we can see a change in a particular protein called amyloid beta 42 in the spinal fluid, maybe as long as 25 years before the expected time of symptoms. Mm-hmm. And after that, there is a change in another protein called tau in the spinal fluid, and a change in the metabolism of the brain, a change in the structure of the brain in that it shrinks, And it's been possible to make a somewhat orderly progression of these markers of the disease, so-called biomarkers. Mm-hmm. And that tells us that we now have a profile of a person who's going to develop Alzheimer's but doesn't yet have symptoms. And that is, of course, very valuable in any disease because you'd like to intervene before a lot of damage to the brain.
So with all this early detection, is there a treatment that's been successful in stopping or delaying the onset of Alzheimer's disease?
There has not yet been a treatment that can claim to have been successful in slowing or preventing or really halting Alzheimer's disease. But all the information about that has been generated in people who already have frank symptoms mm-hmm. of dementia. And so we don't know whether it might be successful if we went earlier. In fact, most in the field believe it would be. What we do know is that even when we treat with experimental drugs people who already have definite symptoms, we see an improvement in the biomarkers. So that's very important. And it's not only the particular biomarker that we may be targeting. Most of the experimental drugs target this amyloid beta 42 protein, but even other proteins that build up secondary to the amyloid beta go down with treatment. That's the so-called tau protein that's our best marker of degenerating nerve cells.
And so is the thinking that once the symptoms are obvious in a cognitive way, you can't reverse it?
It's just like saying if I gave you a statin, which go by brand names like Lipitor and Zocor nowadays, if I gave you that after you had two heart attacks and you had unstable angina from coronary artery disease, would that really help you a lot? And the answer is it would be good to lower your LDL cholesterol, but it would be unlikely to make a big difference in whether you had yet another heart attack or not. In contrast, of course, the way we use statin drugs is to give it to people who have abnormal cholesterol when they're 45 or 50 and hope that they will not develop heart attacks later on. And that has been shown to work. So the Alzheimer field is not where cardiology is. It has not yet sort of been given permission to just test these drugs before any symptoms arise to prevent the development of advanced disease. In cardiac treatment, that's, of course, de rigueur, when always mm-hmm. wants to treat before the first heart attack rather than after.
So if we do start treating these biomarkers, how long would it take for a result to come out, to be able to say, yeah, this is delaying the onset of Alzheimer's?
That's an excellent question. We don't know exactly how long we need to treat to prevent the onset, but I feel that treating people who are very mild, who do have a little bit of symptoms of Alzheimer's, slight forgetfulness on certain days, but other days they seem fine, they're still able to function in everyday life, those very mild patients should be the ones we treat. And there we would follow the biomarkers to see that they don't get worse or maybe even get better, as has been the case in some of our trials up to now, and also follow challenging mental status tests, that is, challenge the patient's memory with somewhat difficult tests and see if on that sensitive scale they do a little better. Now, beyond treating very mild patients, which I think we should do, and we can identify them now, we need to also do true secondary prevention, which means the patient has no symptoms that we can see at all, and the patient does not complain of memory difficulty. But if we look for the biomarkers, they're abnormal already, by scanning the brain or doing a spinal fluid exam. And those patients in secondary prevention trials, they'll be very important. I think you'd probably have to treat them for at least 3 to 5 years to, and then see if any telltale minor memory difficulty they have on challenging memory tests doesn't get worse or just slows down in its progression compared to placebo. So in summary, we're talking about probably trials that last at least 2 years in very mild clinical subjects, mm-hmm. and as long as 3 to 5 years in truly pre-symptomatic secondary prevention.
Hmm. And I just want to talk about the cognitive testing for a second here. You kind of make it sound like the cognitive testing is more sensitive than the biomarker testing.
It's a good point. We think that probably the current biomarkers are a little bit more sensitive in mm-hmm. that they go awry earlier. For example, the A-beta 42 level in the spinal fluid will fall even earlier than challenging cognitive tests.
Mostly we've been talking about when trials should start, when we should intervene and try to turn the course of the disease by examining the biomarkers and their response to treatment. But, you know, we're talking about it as a hypothetical. Are these trials going to happen anytime soon?
Yeah, the good news is that because there have been some prominent failures of treatment trials in so-called mild to moderate Alzheimer's, which is sort of typical Alzheimer's when trials have generally been done, there is so much concern about testing these agents in a better way that people have already designed. In fact, they were designing the trials even while they were waiting for the results of the so-called mild to moderate AD trials. And so some of those trials are virtually ready to go, and some of them are even underway already with similar agents or the same agents that didn't do well clinically in the mild to moderate phase. And then more trials are being designed. So I'd say that it's not like the field will suddenly have to wait for a year, 2 years, or 3 years until the first trials of secondary prevention or very mild AD occur. They're already planned. Some of them are already funded. And a couple of them are actually already underway in very mild subjects.
Okay. Well, Dennis Selko, thanks so much for talking with me.
All right. Nice to talk to you.
Dennis Selko is the author of A Perspective on Averting Alzheimer's in this week's special issue. Also in this special issue, you can find stories on the data behind vitamin D, changing the environment to encourage healthy behavior, vaccines for chronic diseases, and a variety of videos. Check out these features and more articles at www.sciencemag.org/special/prevention.
Food deserts, or communities where grocery stores are few and far between, may be linked to unhealthy eating and obesity. But would supplying neighborhoods with healthy options actually stop unhealthy eating and slim down the populace? In a news story, science writer Jennifer Cousin-Frankel examined the research design to answer this question. Isabel Boney spoke with her about projects in several major cities in the U.S.
So this is an article that is about improving access to healthy foods among mostly underprivileged neighborhoods that currently lack that access. They may not have grocery stores that offer fresh produce or other healthy options like low-fat dairy and so on. And it's about trying to change that in the hopes of changing eating habits and eventually changing obesity rates.
Now, what are some incentives being implemented to promote visits to food markets already?
There have been a number of things that people are trying. So in a couple cities in New York and Philadelphia right now, residents who spend $5 worth of food stamps at a farmer's market get an additional $2 that they can spend there on fruits and vegetables. There are a number of researchers, foundations, local officials who are trying to offer more produce in particular and other healthy foods in small markets, in supermarkets, at areas around the country, both urban and rural areas. And then there are also a number of efforts to coax residents of these neighborhoods to buy some of the foods that are being brought in to everywhere from corner stores to new supermarkets.
So what are some of the efforts to get people to buy healthier foods? Are there any simple, cheap strategies that stores can use on a more local level to encourage this behavior?
Yeah, so there are lots of things that different people are trying to get people to really change their eating habits, which is at the crux of all of this. One is to really think about the community where the store sits and to focus efforts on that community. So there may be certain foods that people in that community are more likely to cook with depending on their background, you know, what they're accustomed to. So stores might focus on, you know, certain produce over other produce that will draw in customers. They might also do some very simple things like changing product displays. We don't think about it so much, but for example, if you're walking down a cereal aisle, your eyes may be drawn to the boxes that are at eye level, not the ones that are near your feet. And so if you flip those around and maybe the Cheerios are at your feet, you move them up to eye level, people might be more likely to see those or to see healthier cereals as opposed to ones that are considered less healthy. You can swap around where the milk might go, put the skim milk in a more visible location or one that you run into before you hit the whole milk. So things like that are certainly being tested out, and those are obviously very cheap interventions and sustainable, and that's something in general that people are thinking about. They don't want to have interventions in place that cost a lot of money to continue on with, because then it's going to be difficult to keep them in place if they are found to work.
Yeah, all seem like good ideas. So what have researchers done? I know in this article you talk about how they want to know whether changes in food markets can increase health behaviors.
So the researchers are trying a lot of different things now because they really want to make sure that they are implementing strategies that are effective and not just throwing healthy food into stores that no one might buy. So one thing they're doing is in Philadelphia, for example, there's a very, very large initiative with hundreds, more than 600 corner stores, small stores in all different neighborhoods around the city that the owners can sign on to the program. And as a result, there are different interventions that they are given. For example, they might be given a new refrigerator that's very attractive and that can hold fresh produce or low-fat yogurt, that sort of thing. In all different cities, people are trying different types of marketing targeted to certain communities to try and convince folks to buy. In San Diego, there is an effort as part of a larger study to educate store employees about healthy foods, and the employees can then help guide their customers towards healthier foods as well.
Mm-hmm. In your article, you also talked about some obstacles to research on the effectiveness of food markets. Could you talk a little bit more about those?
Absolutely, and there are a lot of things about this research that make it difficult to do. So one is just the types of stores we're dealing with. If we're talking about these small corner stores in different communities, many of them do not have electronic cash registers. They don't provide receipts. So that can make it very difficult to track sales over time. You want to know whether customers are buying the healthy food that's being introduced, and that can be tough to determine, at least by just looking at sort of an output of sales like you might be able to do with a larger supermarket. That's one obstacle. Another obstacle is whether people are actually eating what they buy. We assume that if people, you know, are buying, say, spinach, then they're going to eat it. But we've also all had, you know, spinach go bad in our refrigerator and thrown it out. So we don't really know whether people are eating what they buy. There was an effort or a plan in a San Diego project to actually measure carotenoid levels in blood, which are it's a component of fruits and vegetables, to see if people were ingesting more over time. And that side project had to get cut from this larger study. But that's something people are thinking about. How do we know whether customers are buying what they eat? And another is that it's often difficult to really track people's eating habits over time. You know, you're relying on people to fill out surveys, to go by memory, and remember what they've eaten, and all of that is challenging. So it's tough to really get very good data, and it can also be very expensive.
Mm-hmm. So what about pricing? Isn't it more expensive to eat healthier foods?
A lot of people think that, and it certainly can be a lot more expensive. It really depends what you eat. It does not have to be more expensive. So that's definitely something that everyone who is working in this area is thinking about, because they recognize that, you know, if they just start promoting organic raspberries or something that costs a lot of money, that could be prohibitive for people who are living in these communities and who are often on very tight budgets. So researchers are certainly thinking about, you know, cheaper produce, and that could mean tomatoes, zucchinis, bananas, apples. There's a lot of produce actually that really isn't all that expensive compared to the less healthy food that people are already buying. And along with that, researchers are trying to think about, how do you change habits? We're all used to buying the same kinds of food most of the time and cooking a lot of the same dishes. So researchers are trying to find affordable produce or other items that could, say, be bought in bulk and that might accommodate meals that consumers might be interested in trying out. Some stores also even have cooking demonstrations or other education around how to use the new items that are introduced in meals.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good to know. Now, looking at this study more overall, there's a key assumption being made in this type of study that may not necessarily be true about the relationship between access to healthier foods and weight. So can you talk about that?
Sure. So I think when people talk about increasing access to healthy foods as a way to make people healthier, basically, to improve overall health, there's this assumption that if you eat more healthy food, that means you're going to eat less unhealthy food. So the healthy food is replacing the unhealthy food. And that makes sense, but we really don't know that it's true. It's not something that has really been carefully looked at. So that's a concern of some people. You know, we're introducing all this healthy food, and that's great. And of course, it's good for people to eat healthy food. But when we think about obesity in particular, does having more healthy food, you know, a few blocks away from you mean that you're eating less unhealthy food, or are you just adding the healthy food to your diet on top of everything else?
Mm-hmm.
And that's still good. That certainly helps prevent diseases like cancer and heart attacks and so on, even if you're still eating the unhealthy food. But if our goal is also to reduce obesity, in the long run, improving access to healthy foods may have less of an effect if it's not overriding the eating of unhealthy foods.
All right, so is there cause for optimism in the future? What is left to be examined about food markets?
Yeah, I think that in some ways we're actually near the beginning of all of this, because people have only in the last few years been trying to really look systematically at what strategies make a difference. And I think we are certainly seeing hints that we can change eating habits and that people will eat more healthy foods. A lot of people do want to be healthy. And if you offer them healthy food and offer them, you know, guidance about how to use it and make it affordable, people may well eat it. You know, I think we still really need to understand whether over the long run that is going to help prevent obesity or help people lose weight. So that's something people, researchers, are interested in looking at, although it's tough to do. But a lot of studies are now trying to get at this question, try to figure out which approaches make the most sense, so we're not just spending money on everything without knowing what's most effective.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Cousin-Frankel writes about food deserts in a special issue this week in Science.
And that concludes the September 21st, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.